So since this is the first of many lectures on quantum information and quantum computing, I will define quantum computation in kind of an idiosyncratic fashion. This isn't a rigorous definition, but these are sort of the steps as I see it. You have to have a Hilbert space, H. You have to have some initial vector that you can arrange to begin the calculation in the Hilbert space. And then you need a representation. You need some set of operations, and rho is the usual letter for representation, which carries each operation into a unitary, or it's enough to be a projective unitary transformation of the Hilbert space. So these operations are gates in some examples. You need a compiler, which is a purely classical step, which takes the problem, like factoring and the instance, the number you're trying to factor, and turns it into a string of operations. So this is sort of the software part of quantum computation. Then once you have the string S of operations, rho of that string is a unitary transformation of your Hilbert space. In other words, that's the implementation of that string on the Hilbert space. And it transforms the initial vector to a final vector. And the last quantum step is then observation. You have to measure something about the quantum state and look at the answer. And then maybe you repeat these processes many times and you have a certain amount of experimental answers, and then there's sort of a classical synthesis step where you get to look at all those zeros and ones or whatever you've been observing and turn them into a factor for your number. So I carefully arranged the definition of quantum computer not to say the word qubit. So now I've said it. Most of the world who thinks about quantum computation thinks in terms of various qubit models or local models of computation. What I want to talk about today are the prospects for anionic computation. So let me, well, maybe I can use the second screen here. Let me show you how those steps just schematically might work in an anionic system. So first, anion, that's some kind of humorous takeoff on other ons, like electron or something. The first three letters are any, which refer to statistics. In ordinary context, we learn about fermions and bosons, and they're separated by having two different statistics. If you exchange identical fermions, a minus one appears in the wave function, and identical bosons, there's no change. And in fact, in three dimensions, there's really only up to deformation one way of exchanging two things without them colliding. So if you exchange back, it's the identity. So you'd expect, since the operation has order two, that there are only two possible eigenvalues, plus and minus one, and that's fermion and boson. But an interesting thing happens if you imagine you're living in flatland. If you have a two-dimensional spatial world, then there's sort of a counterclockwise exchange and a clockwise exchange. And if you take multiples of this, say, clockwise exchange, you don't ever get back to the identity. The thing just keeps twisting up to deformation through non-colliding trajectories. So this leaves open the possibility that particles in two dimensions might have more interesting statistics. Like they might, for example, change by, the wave function might change by a phase e to the 2 pi I over 3, which is in fact part of Laughlin's theory of fractional quantum Hall effect. So an anion is something that occurs in a two-dimensional system, and they're not fundamental new particles, but there are things in these systems mathematically which look like particles. They're excited states which have exponential decay. So if you ignore the tails, it looks like the excitation is concentrated near a point, and you can call it a particle or a quasi-particle. And an anionic system is essentially a Hamiltonian on some two-dimensional lattice that admits excitations which you can understand, which have this concentrated property, and that have analyzable braiding and fusion rules. So you have to, in an anionic system, you have to be able to start with sort of a vacuum, a lowest energy state. You have to be able to like hit it with a hammer or something. You have to add energy to it to bring out pairs of excitations. Maybe you have to figure out what things you've made. But once you have a list of known excitations, you can act on some degrees of freedom in the system, which are in addition to the physical position of the excitations. So these are sort of internal symmetries. You have a finite dimensional Hilbert space of internal symmetries in these anionic systems, which actually contain information about what would happen if you fused various pairs of these excitations. So this state of internal symmetries is actually what I want to, what people who think about anionic computation use as their quantum computer. That's the Hilbert space of the quantum computers, the internal symmetries. And the operations, the representation, is the braid group. It's called braiding because if you sort of dozy-do these excitations around each other, if you think of their trajectories in two-dimensional space-time in 2 plus 1 dimensions, then you see a braid emerging. So particles move vertically in time. So after you braid them, you don't preserve this pair structure when you braid them. You can braid them in an arbitrary way. And then when you, say, take two consecutive particles in this picture and bring them together and fuse them, there are different results in the theory that could happen. You know, maybe if you did nothing, if you created a pair out of the vacuum and then immediately brought them together and fused them, you'd expect them to disappear and have sort of the empty particle left. But in these theories, after you've acted on the state by these complicated braids, when you bring a pair together and fuse it, there may be a probability that you don't get the empty particle, but you get some other recognizable particle of the theory. And that's sort of the output of the quantum computer. That's like applying the sigma x operator to a qubit and seeing either 0 or 1 with some probability. You know, it's the usual output of quantum computation. Here, we imagine doing a braid, that's the calculation, and then the observation is to fuse a pair and see what kind of quasi-particle results by some kind of physical measurement. And then you take the list of answers and you synthesize it, you know, in the same way as you would in more standard models. I'm sorry? Well, so, in these various theories, there's a finite number of different particle types. One way of saying what this means So there'll be a finite sort of table of local excitations and fusion rules between them. The number of particle types can be described in terms of, to give a mathematical answer to this, you have to talk about a TQFT on a surface with boundary, and the boundary label is the particle type. The simplest context is actually to get rid of the boundary and talk about a closed surface. So if you want to count the particles in the theory, you can look at the torus. And the number of particles in the theory is the ground state degeneracy of the theory on the torus. So like in this fractional quantum Hall effect, depending on what filling fraction you have, the ground state of the Hamiltonian, you know, has dimensions 2, 3, 4. I don't know. Is that perhaps? Maybe I can do a better job. I mean, so let me put the a small rundown on the, as far as I know, the only physical system which is believed to, the only known physical system of anionic character seems to be these two-dimensional electron liquids, the so-called fractional quantum Hall effect systems. And I don't want to, you know, try to describe the physics of these except say it's some kind of flat land of electrons. So usually electrons confined to some small disk less than a square centimeter with some very strong transverse magnetic field that is important in that it creates a chirality. There's some difference between right-handed and left-handedness in these theories. And this filling in the fractional quantum Hall states, if you consider the Schrodinger equation for a single electron, you find that there's a large number of states depending on the strength of the transverse magnetic field, which all have equal energy. So this is called the first Landau level. And this fraction is what fraction of those states are occupied by the electrons. And if you put in certain small integer fractions like these, it's believed that the electrons under their Coulomb repulsion organize themselves into some beautiful hierarchical pattern, their wave function, that admits excitations, which from the outside would appear to have fractional charge and exotic statistics when the excitations are braided around each other. So the excitations in a quantum Hall system are sort of the only experimentally known instances of quasiparticles. What apparently is measured even in these theories is the fractional charge of the excitations rather than this exotic phase that occurs under braiding. The exotic phase is part of the mathematical model. Physicists believe it, but at least at nu equals a third. But it's hard to measure phase directly. You need some kind of Aronoff-Bohm experiment or something. It's very difficult to do in this kind of context. So the so these fractions here, if you've ever looked at this, these models of fractional quantum Hall, these they're sometimes referred to as plateaus, and they correspond to stable regimes, which you know people refer to as different phases of matter, sort of an analogy to you know gas, liquid, solid, whatever. You know these are little flatland materials that each are their sort of their own world. They're mathematically, it's believed there are countably many of them, describing more and more complex anionic systems. But if you look experimentally, they kind of start to run out. Each plateau, as the fraction gets larger and larger in numerator and denominator, each plateau becomes finer, and the energy gap associated with that phase is believed to get smaller. So these are extremely delicate systems, and that's why I call this an impractical candidate. If these systems had a large energy gap, this would be a good way to build a quantum computer, probably. And you know that could be this model, this little disk could be a quantum Hall system. Now, the reason that these systems are so weak is because technologically there's a limit to how strong the transverse magnetic field can be made. And the size of the Landau level is proportional, the number of electrons that can be squeezed in is, you can only get one electron per magnetic area. And there's a magnetic length scale, which is, the length scale shrinks to square root of one over the magnetic field. So if you make the magnetic field stronger, you can get more electrons in and have them closer together, but there's a limit technologically at how strong those fields can be. So essentially, these electrons are very far apart. The gas is quite dilute, and they're only feeling each other weakly. So whatever configurations they assume to, you know, find their minimum energy is very easily disturbed by thermal fluctuations. So that's why these systems have to be studied at millikelvin and in very exact crystal boundaries, and they're quite difficult systems. So the mathematical source of the problem, you could say, is these are these systems, these anionic systems, are chiral. They have this central charge, they got smeared, which is the level, the L 3L divided by L plus 2. So I just want to, I may lapse and use a mathematical term. So the physical term is anionic system, and the mathematical term is either TQFT, topological quantum field theory, or a more exact mathematical term is topological modular functor. And if, that's kind of the terminology that a topologist would use. But I guess I've been sort of trained to try to say anionic system. But basically what this means, you know, whether I say modular functor or anionic system, all it means really is braid group representation. You have to know what happens to the space of internal degrees of freedom when you dozy-do the particles around each other. And if you have all that information, plus the fusion rules, then that's the anionic system. So what I'd like to do today is talk about the possibility of building, you know, in the world, a achiral medium which could be used for computation. And I'm thinking of some kind of, I'll present some kind of magnetic model to you of what such a medium might look like. And the two possible advantages are, one, on a physical level, it could be conceivably very robust physically because it doesn't have this diluteness that's inherent in a quantum Hall system. There's no, I don't see any fundamental reason why it couldn't have a very large energy gap, that it couldn't you know, work even at room temperature possibly. From a mathematical point of view, these modular functors that I'll be discussing, or anionic systems, are actually not irreducible. They have a doubled character. It turns out that there's some theory which is V. They're isomorphic to V tensor, it's dual. And the theories that arise in the quantum Hall systems are like the Vs themselves. So V is a chiral theory, and V star is a theory of the opposite chirality. But when they're, the only way that, so chirality has to do with breaking time reversal symmetry. And the way that time reversal symmetry is broken in the quantum Hall systems is by the magnetic field, which is considered sort of outside the system. So if you want to break time symmetry strongly, you have to have a very powerful magnetic field. And there's a technological limit to how intense the magnetic field can be made. You know, how many Tesla, 15 Tesla or something. So the fragility of quantum Hall systems has to do with their with the fact that they're inherently chiral. They need time symmetry broken. The way that's done is with the magnetic field. Magnetic field can only be so strong. I want to talk about a system that has C equals zero, and therefore could be much more stable. And from a mathematical point of view, you should not be scared of the fact that this is some kind of double. It's actually, the double is actually much more tractable than the original system. This is a bit of philosophy that I learned from Alexei Kataev. So what I want to do is describe on a mathematical level, and this is sort of where the talk begins, I want to describe a system and say what I can about its perturbation theory. So the system will be, I'll construct some kind of raw Hilbert space and a Hamiltonian. There's a parameter L, which is the level of the theory. But this will be some very simple local Hamiltonian, which, you know, you could be written out in terms of sigma X's and sigma Z's if you wanted. So there's some local Hamiltonian, which is defined on a lattice where it, or a triangulation of a surface where at every vertice of the surface you set a qubit down. So the big Hilbert space H will be a tensor product of C2s, one C2 for each vertex. It'll be some quantum vertex model. There's some Hamiltonian, which I'll explain. And the anionic system, or the modular functor, whatever you want to call it, is going to be the ground state, not of this Hamiltonian, but of a generic perturbation of it. So we have to understand perturbations of the Hamiltonian I'll describe. And I think this would be impossible to do analytically. I have no idea how one could approach this. But it's an algebraic idea to understand the perturbations, which comes from a phenomenon in C-star algebras called rigidity. And these Hamiltonians can be interpreted as kind of quantum mechanical loop gases. So I want to explain that. So this is sort of what I want to do today. Now, what would be most interesting would be to talk about an actual physical system that had this Hamiltonian. And I don't know how to do that. So I hope to come back next year and talk about what physical system has H zeros, comma L. But right now, I can't. So I'll just tell you what H zero, comma L would do if you found a physical system, which was described by it. Yes, this is a qualitative distinction, or quantitative distinction. So I'll use letter Y for a surface. It might be a closed surface, or if the surface has a boundary, there'll be some boundary conditions. And I'll be trying to explain what the ground state space is, so the lowest energy eigenspace of this Hamiltonian, which shortly I'll tell you explicitly what it is, on the surface. And the Hamiltonian is cooked up so that its ground state space is this algebra. It's isomorphic to the temporary Lieb algebra, denoted this way, of the surface. And this number D, that's a real number, it's one of the Barra numbers, 2 cosine pi over L plus 2. So, for instance, a very important example is when L is equal to 2 and D is square root of 2. And another interesting example is when L is equal to 3 and D is the golden ratio. These are sort of the two most interesting cases. So I'll explain what this algebra is. And the important thing is that we expect this algebra to collapse under perturbation, the ground state to become somewhat smaller if the Hamiltonian is perturbed. And the ground state space under perturbation should be a quotient of the temporary Lieb algebra, which is this anionic system. It's a known anionic system in mathematics, and it's written this way. I'll just tell you the way it's written. It's written the Drinfield double of the Chern-Simons modular functor of the Lie group SO3 at level L on the surface. Okay, and I just abbreviate that DEL. D is for double, E is for the even theory. SO3 is the even part of the theory. So it doesn't matter all this terminology. The point is that this is some known braid group representation going back to the Jones polynomial in 1986. So for 15 years, somewhere in mathematics, these rules for what would happen if you braided these quasi-particles around each other have been known, those representations. And what I'm trying to do is produce a local Hamiltonian that's easy to describe that will give rise to those representations. So I'm trying to give a local genesis for the Jones representations. Okay, so what are all these things? I've thrown some kind of crazy notation at you. The Hamiltonian, the perturbed Hamiltonian, the temporary Lieb algebra, and this anionic system that comes by perturbing it. So I have to kind of make you comfortable with these things. And then I have to try to, so far I've just been blathering in a way, I have to give you what's the evidence that the ground state would be this anionic system that is comfortable from a mathematical point of view. Hmm. So let me just continue the blather one slide longer. This is a hypothetical picture of the ground state spaces for this family of Hamiltonians and its perturbation. So there's this parameter D, which is related to L by that trigonometric formula, which kind of goes out this way, giving you more and more complicated systems. So this is D equals 1, square root of 2 up to 2 and beyond 2. And there's a kind of the unperturbed Hamiltonian, H0, sort of on this line. And this line is unstable. It's the boundary between phases until you get to the square root of 2. And then it becomes stable. There's a stable regime, and then the perturbation has to be larger to get out of that stable regime. And the sort of picture I'm arguing for, it's, you know, it's partially conjectural, but it's supported by some mathematics, is that above these special numbers, these so-called Barra numbers, if you add a perturbation, you sort of jump into a topological phase. And these topological phases are distinct. There's a countable number of them, and they become more and more interesting as you go to the right, but also probably smaller and harder to hit. And this is this double-checked stuff. The ones that are double-hatched are the ones that are computationally universal. If you could make a quantum medium that had those Brady rules, that would be a universal quantum computer. And the topological phases that are weak, that you could only do some operations, you couldn't do universal computation, those are the singly shaded regions, which corresponds to levels 1, 2, and 4. And these levels 3, 5, 6, 7, and so on are the robust phases. So that's your universal quantum computing. So one thing that comes out of this investigation, which is something many of you have noticed in your own research, is that it's possible that nature abhors a quantum computer for one reason or another. And if you were a pessimist, you would take this slide as some evidence for that, because it looks like there's this nice Hamiltonian, and sitting along it you can perturb and you can get into an anionic system. But as soon as you want to get to an anionic system that's universal, it's no longer accessible by perturbation, so you might not be able to find it. I'm hoping one can still find it, but it's curious that the numerology works out to make engineering a universal anionic system seem a bit harder than a weak one. It's related to the stability.
Not
necessarily. I mean, these are stable. These should also be stable phases. The thing that's unstable is the unperturbed Hamiltonian, and as soon as you move off it, you end up in a stable phase, but it's just a question of how rich that is.
And how do you know just from the Brady rule that you're
doing? Yeah, that's investigated by, in a series of papers, or a couple of papers that I wrote with Wong and Mike Larson. Basically, in terms of a rule of thumb, it's whether the Braid group is dense. The image under the representation of the Braid group is dense in some on the modular functor for some simple surface. So for instance, if you take a four punctured sphere and you look at the image of braiding in the Hilbert space, which is the internal degrees of symmetry associated to four quasi particles located at those punctures, that's a mathematical representation. It's one of the Jones representations. So it's a question you can analyze whether that has a dense image. And if it does have a dense image, it means that you can write down some word that closely approximates any gate in that Hilbert space that you'd want to achieve. And then you use the Kataev-Solvay algorithm to say that it's not just, you know, an abstract solution to the problem, but there's a constructive polynomially efficient way of approximating that gate. D is Grinfeld. D stands for either Grinfeld or double. It means that it's achiral. No, I mean, this is just a notation. There's some integer family of anionic systems. That's all this means to you. D and E should... Yeah, I mean, there's, so there's, okay, in terms of the Jones polynomial, which may be familiar, the Jones polynomial is a polynomial invariant of a link, but you can turn it into a number, complex number, by evaluating the Jones polynomial at a root of unity, okay? And you get a more interesting number as that root of unity gets closer to 1, okay? So if you plug in the root of unity, e to the 2 pi I over 5, you get very difficult information out of the Jones polynomial, actually sharp P hard information, that algebraic integer. Whereas if you put in a fourth root of unity, you get some polynomial time invariant. So the information in these theories is essentially the same as the information of the Jones polynomial on a link evaluated at the root of unity, somehow corresponding to this last number. What you do is you add 2. You know, so if you see a 3 here, it should be the fifth root of unity.
What's the question? I didn't quite understand that question. I stated that you made before. You were referring to the Lorentz questions
No, these are the perturbed, everything above, this is epsilon equals 0. This is, the horizontal line is sort of the unperturbed picture. And then when you add a perturbation, what I will argue for are stable phases that as this parameter increases become more and more complicated representations. And there's, we don't need very complicated representations, there's a threshold. As soon as you have dense image, you have universality. So probably this is a very privileged fellow. This is probably the one to try to build. And it's related to the golden ratio is the beautiful thing. I'm not quite sure what you mean by that. Maybe we'll talk afterwards.
Can I just ask what, you mentioned a surface a couple of times.
Yeah.
So I imagine that you have some operator on the surface, like a Laplacian and potentials and something else that you're going to add or multiply or something to get something new Paul Hamilton.
Well, yeah, that's actually not a bad picture. So what you should think of is, think of the surface as triangulated at a very fine scale. So like the triangular lattice in the plane divided out by 2 translations, that would be, dividing out by the 2 translations would turn the plane into a torus, and then you'd have a fine triangulation but finite on the torus. And now the Hamiltonian would just be some sum of local interactions, which I can specify in a neighborhood of each vertex.
So what are the basic operators that I'm building these interactions of? What do they act on?
Well, let me use the blackboard for a moment. So if I have a bunch of vertices, and on each one I have a C2, then the Hilbert space is the tensor product over the vertices of these C2s, okay? And now if I have a local operator, I'll mean local in the sense of the triangulation of the surface, that every time I put my finger on a vertex, I look at that vertex and the neighboring vertices. So for instance, if it was the triangular lattice in the plane, there'd be 6 neighbors to each. Each vertex would have 6 neighbors. That would correspond to a decomposition of the Hilbert space into near and far. There'd be a tensor of 7 guys, the center and its 6 neighbors, and then tensor the far, so sort of capital N minus 7 C2s. So in other words, this at every vertex, there's a tensor decomposition of the Hilbert space into the near and the far. And then what the Hamiltonian will be, it'll be some Hermitian operator, H, which acts here, tensor the identity acting here. And then I'll sum up over all vertices. So this is, you know, a simple example would be the Heisenberg magnet. The Heisenberg magnet is written usually something like this, the summation over bonds, ij connected by a bond in a lattice, of the Pauli matrix, let me write it this way, sigma I sigma j physicists write it like that. That means you sum over the missing index, which is the type of polymatrix. So this is short for three terms, sigma x at I plus sigma y. Well, I'm going behind the screen.
From a physics point of view, it's fundamental to say that you have what I would call spins on each side, and you have these.
Yeah, that's right. There's spin a half part.
Are you restricting yourself to spins on the sides?
Yeah, it's a C2 on each side, so you can take it as a two-level spin system at each side.
That's what you mean by C2.
Well, that's an example of a physical system that would be described by C2, is a spin system. I'm just thinking how far. I postponed the definition. Maybe I should unpostpone it. Here's the definition of the Hamiltonian, but I wanted to motivate it. Okay, I'll put the definition on the big screen, and I'll put the motivation on the little screen. I tried to use physics notation. So the motivation is the temporary Lieb algebra, so I think I need to explain what this is on a surface. I mean, this is actually some physics. Temporally, at least, as a physicist, and Lieb. So for them, this was an operator algebra. It was the transfer matrices in the six vertex model in statistical physics. But I want to make an element of the temporary Lieb algebra a vector. Okay, it's a vector in a Hilbert space. It's not going to be an operator on anything. Though you could recast this in sort of a two-category discussion where they'd again become operators. But the simplest thing is what I'm going to present. So the temporary Lieb algebra has this very important real number d, which, as I said before, might be the square root of 2 or a golden ratio or something. That's going to be fixed. It's a positive real number. And it has another subscript which eventually will disappear, which is just in these diagrams, the number of strands. So this picture here is for n equals 4. So the objects in the algebra are just little pictures like this with scalar, it's formal linear combinations of little pictures. So I can multiply a picture by a scalar if I want. And the algebra is generated when n equals 4 by these four diagrams. This is the identity. This is E1, E2, and E3. And what the product is, as I've illustrated by an example here, is stacking vertically. So if I want to multiply E1 times E1, I go and look and I see what E1 is. It's some picture. And that, you see what I've done here is, if you cut that in two, you see E1 above and below. So I stack them together, and I get this kind of complicated picture. And then it has a coefficient d squared, 1 over d squared, by multiplying the coefficients. But then I do an interesting thing. I erase the circle. This is sort of their idea. And a circle's worth d in the theory. So that's what the parameter d is. It's the real number that tells you exactly how much a circle is worth. So from this little calculation, we just checked that E1 is idempotent. E1 times E1 is back to E1. And these are all idempotents. And here I just did another sample product for you. I just multiplied two generators and got some picture. So this is sort of all the vertical strip doodles you could make of four strands. And this is concatenation as times, and the algebra is the formal linear combinations of them. And you can prove that they satisfy these relations. This is the idempotence. This says the two basic things commute if they're far away from each other. But if the two basic moves are, these are kind of recouplings. If two basic recouplings occur next to each other, then they have a more subtle relation, and that's given here. And when you say times, you mean vertical stacking, but I just want to point out that this is a tensor algebra, that you can also stack horizontally. If you have P strands and Q strands, you can get P plus Q strands by horizontal stacking, and then that gives a tensor structure among the different grades of this algebra. Well, this algebra, I'll keep it up on this other transparency just for a moment. This other algebra, or this temporary Lieb algebra, has a beautiful inner product on it called the Markov trace, or Markov trace pairing. So if you have two pictures, A and B, you define their inner product to be the trace of AB bar. So this is a familiar formula. It's called a Frobenius algebra. Anytime you take a commutative algebra with a trace and you make a pairing this way. So here it's very beautiful. B bar just means you complex conjugate whatever coefficient you see, and you flip the picture upside down, vertical reflection. That's the barring. So I'm giving an example here. You have this picture, you want inner product that picture. Well, you flip this upside down, nothing happens. The coefficients are 1, so they don't get flipped either. You multiply them, that means you stack one picture on top of the other. And then the trace thing is you just take the top strands and connect them around to the bottom strands like that. So I drew that there. And then you use the same rule I pointed out once before, that every closed circle is counted as a multiple of D. So there happens in this example to be just one closed circle topologically. So this is the inner product of those two diagrams. Now,
is it obvious how you connect things when you go around?
That's the definition. I mean, you keep them in order. You don't cross them.
Okay.
Yeah. You have to keep them in order, because in this theory I haven't introduced under and over crossings. This is purely a two-dimensional theory. So you couldn't get mixed up even if you tried. Now, whenever you have an inner product, an algebraist would look immediately for the radical of the inner product. That's those things which pair zero with everything. And it turns out, well, it's quite obvious that the radical is an ideal in the algebra, just because if something pairs zero with everything and you multiply it by something else, then it's certainly going to pair zero with any other thing. So it's certainly an ideal. And it turns out it's by far the most interesting ideal in these algebras. Okay, and in fact, it has one generator in each. Well, there's a parameter here. That's the d. For every Barad number d, there's an integer l, and for every one of those algebras l, there's exactly one generator for this ideal. And if d is not one of those special numbers, 2 cosine pi over integer, then there is no radical at all. Okay, the radical vanishes, it's zero. So the only times you get a radical is when d is a special number, and then the radical is has a single generator. And there's this theorem of Goodman and Wenzel, this is in the sort of the von Jones C-star algebra school, which says that this is the only interesting ideal in these radicals, in this algebra. So I have to explain what this means. This is a kind of a beautiful, slightly mind-stretching idea. So we had times, which was vertical stacking, and we had tensor, which was horizontal stacking. But if you're a topologist, you don't want to be bothered with whether you're stacking at an angle or vertically or horizontally. You'd much rather just kind of generalize this to extending from a small picture to a large picture and not worry whether you're extending to the right or left. And this would be some kind of notion which extended both times and tensor. So you can make what's called a surface algebra, and given any surface y, so here's, I drew a surface, you can think about squiggly diagrams of curves like this that you draw on the surface y, and you could think of the algebra generated by formal linear combinations of those pictures of curves up to deformation. And now what an ideal would be any set, a set of curves or a set of pictures would be an ideal if restricted to a small piece. So that's this disk in this picture. You could arrange the picture to be of a certain form on this disk and then arbitrary on the outside. That would be the ideal generated by that form on that disk. And if you had a collection of forms, then you could make the ideal generated by all those forms. So, just to repeat, a picture in a disk, you should think of as just, well, concretely, a picture is just some pattern of curves and circles in the disk. But we actually deal always with linear combinations of these. So we have a fixed boundary structure in mind, fixed number of points where the pattern is exiting the disk. But inside, it might be a linear combination of, say, 14 pictures, superposition of 14 pictures. And then the ideal that generates would be the all pictures which, all formal pictures which are extensions of that. And it turns out in this more flexible context of a surface algebra, this is the, these are the only ideals. So for example, if you took the empty picture, that would generate the whole algebra, because any picture with curves in it, you can push the curves off a disk. So the empty picture always can be extended. You can arrive at anything by extending the empty picture. So that means the empty picture generates the whole algebra. That's like saying one generates the integers. So it's already known sort of from algebraists that there is this this very rare and rigid phenomenon, that these surface algebras admit either no quotients for D, a general number, or one quotient, one interesting reduction when D is a special number. And with some topological coworkers, Kevin Walker and Zihang Wang, we identified this quotient when it exists as this anionic system. Okay. So in particular, a special case, what that means, I mean, just lining up dimensions, is that if you have a closed surface, like here I drew a genus 2 surface, and you look at all the vector space generated by all pictures of curves that could be drawn on it, and you divide out by this radical, you get all of a sudden a finite dimensional vector space, and it's the vector space associated with this anionic system. So for instance, if it was the torus, the dimension of the vector space would be the number of particles. So this is the rigidity that I referred to. It's the fact that there's only this one ideal, and this motivates the definition of the Hamiltonian. What motivates the definition of the Hamiltonian is, let me go back a slide, is actually the temporary Lebesgue algebra. So let's see, I think it might be helpful if I drew something here. Here we go. So let's so we have this triangulation of a surface. And I'm going to have spin a half particles, as I said, on the vertices. And the Hilbert space will be this tensor product over the vertices of spin up or spin down. And if I take the up particles, if I take a classical state, which is this, the basis vectors for this Hilbert space are just made by assigning a definite spin up or down to each vertex, then I can think of the spin as defining up or down on the dual cell containing that vertex. So in the case of the usual triangulation of the plane, the dual cells would be hexagons. So think of it more geometrically, when I have a spin up at a vertex, think of it as coloring, say, that hexagon that centered that vertex red. And now I can look at all the red hexagons in the spin configuration. And those are the sort of the up ones. And then I can think about the down hexagons. Those will be the, say, the blue ones. And then there'll be this domain wall, which should be black or something, but I'm out of colors. But anyway, there'll be a domain wall between up and down spin. And that's the connection to these temporary lead pictures. All those black lines, the wiggles there, are domain walls in a spin system. Okay? So I'm trying to implement, the purpose of the Hamiltonian is going to be to implement the rules of the temporary Lebesgue algebra in the ground state of a spin system. So the first rule in the temporary Lebesgue algebra is that pictures only matter up to isotopy. So what that means is, on the level of the Hamiltonian, if I have two different domain walls, say this is a domain wall, and I have the same domain wall, except it changes by a bulge. So, well, that might happen. How would that happen? That would happen if there were some domain that was, say, formally plus, that met the domain wall in an arc. And then if you flip the sign on that domain and turned it into minus, then the domain wall between plus and minus would get deformed to the left, right? So there are certain configurations where if you flipped a spin, the domain wall would move by an isotopy. And there are certain configurations where if you flipped a spin, the domain wall would change its topological character. For example, suppose the domain wall looked like this. There was minus here and plus here. And suppose there was a cell around a vertex there. And well, originally, say it's minus, then we're in this picture. But if we flip to plus, then we see we've changed the topology so as to recouple the domain wall. So what the Hamiltonian does is it charges an energy penalty if the superposition of classical states is not democratic with respect to isotopy. So that's this first term in the Hamiltonian. This first sum here, I mean, it will take a minute to see that I've expressed in symbols what I'm saying, but so what you see here is some coefficient Gij of a plaquette. That's one of those hexagons, and Gij is either 0 or 1, and then you see a classical state Si and Sj, and in the case when Gij of C is 1, Si and Sj are the same state, except they differ by flipping the sign on that one plaquette. That's what this notation means. And Gij is set equal to 1 if flipping that plaquette just moves the wall by an isotopy. So what this term does is it allows, in fact, enforces fluctuation between states that are isotopic to each other. I mean, so the notation is I'm projecting this operator here is just simply orthogonal projection onto the vector Si minus Sj. So I'm saying if you look at the two-dimensional Hilbert space spanned by Si and Sj, the two classical states that differ by a single flip, then I'm taking orthogonal projection onto the vector Si minus Sj. So the only vectors in this two-dimensional section which are not penalized, which get energy zero under this projector, are the ones on the diagonal. They're the ones where Si, the coefficient of Si equals the coefficient of Sj. So that term in the Hamiltonian just says that if two classical spin configurations have the same, are isotopic, then they have to have the same coefficients. And if they don't have the same coefficients, a penalty is charged by that term in the Hamiltonian. Now, what the second term says is that if you pluck out a zero from the picture, you know, if you remove, not a zero, a circle, an O, if you pull out an O, so an O would arise if you had a sea of, say, negative sites and one positive site floating there, and now you flip the sign, you pull it out, well, then what should happen is exactly what happens in the temporary Lieb algebra. That is, if you create an extra circle, the configuration is weighted by multiplying by d, and if you remove a circle, the weight changes by 1 over d. So that's what these two terms do. And it's possible to express this in terms of Pauli matrices, and you get something that looks like the Heisenberg thing, except vastly more complicated, because in order to write down the condition that the walls meet in a connected arc on a cell, you have to look quite a bit around. You might have to have, like, look at 7 sites. And so the order 7 in the Pauli matrices. So that way, it's how it looks extremely complicated. But in some ways, this Hamiltonian is easy to analyze because, you know, the Heisenberg magnet, people still don't know the ground state in two dimensions, but I know exactly the ground state of this Hamiltonian, and it's no big calculation because the Hamiltonian was engineered to have the temporary Lebesgue algebra as the ground state. You know, the relations enforce the relations of the algebra. Okay.
It looks like the coefficients depend on the state.
Yeah. So this is, this sum takes place over pairs of spin states. So they're two to the, if they're n vertices, they're two to the n of these guys and two to the n of these guys, and then they're n plaquettes. So it's a big sum. It's over n times two to the n plus one. Things, and most of the terms in the sum are zero. There are only a few coefficients of which are one. So for a coefficient to be one, you need the plaquette to have to be very special with respect to these two classical states. You need to have, that's what's expressed in this notation, you need to have the second state arise from the first state by flipping the spin at site C in the first state. There must be some better notation, but I couldn't think of it. The way I think of this Hamiltonian, it's positive semi-definite. Okay, each term in it is a projector, so it either has eigenvalue 1 or 0. So it's like an exam. You know, you like remember when you had to take the college entrance exam or something? You either get a 0 or 1 every time you answer a question. So now you want to see what's the energy of some state. Well, it's a superposition of things. You just go to every site, and there's a question at that site. And the question is, if you...
So these coefficients are actually operators themselves.
No, these coefficients are 0 or 1.
No, but they depend on what the state is. When I'm used to writing Hamiltonians, I have some operators that happen on the state. But I can call these things times numerical coefficients, which are specified independent of the state on which the operators are going to have. Your coefficients mainly depend on the state on which this Hamiltonian.
Well, yes, yeah, they certainly do depend on the state. It only looks at these states locally near C. Well, no, I'm sorry, that isn't right. I take that back. I mean, this. I had some different notation for this, which might have been better, but I could try that. I mean, the point is that Si and Sj have to be almost identical in order to get a non-zero coefficient here. They have to differ at when inspected at site C. That has to be the only place they differ. No, I mean, it has nothing to do with the Heisenberg magnitude. I mean, that's just an example of something that can be written as products of, it, that's something that's quadratic in polymatrices as a Heisenberg magnet. If you wanted to write this out in polymatrices, it would be order 7 in polymatrices. So you might say this is a ridiculously complicated Hamiltonian if that's your only criteria for simplicity. But I've written it in a fairly compact notation to try to persuade you that it's, in some sense, a simple Hamiltonian. But it. But the definition, you know, is topological. I mean, if you have a hexagon, then this condition which activates the coefficient makes the coefficient 1 or 0. The condition can be achieved in several different ways, because the condition is that the domain wall between plus spins and minus spins as it crosses the boundary of that hexagon should cross it in a connected arc. So for instance, it could be 4 consecutive edges, that's a connected arc, or 2 consecutive edges. There are many different patterns. So if you try to write all that out in polymatrices, you get a very long mess. But from the topological ideas, you know, summarized by this picture, that if a domain wall, you want to force domain walls to fluctuate as long as it doesn't interfere with their topology. But you want to forbid domain or penalize the fluctuation of domain walls when it changes their topology. But the combinatorics of that expressed in terms of polymatrices is, I mean, that's not an efficient way to express it, that's all. Sorry, can one think of it as what? Yes, 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 that's half. That, then now you're halfway there. You have two things in the relation. One is the notion of isotopy, and the other is the notion of killing a small circle. Killing a small circle also has to be related by this factor D. So when you say sum over an isotopy, let's see. Just looking for a little blank. Oh, here's some transparency. So let me just point out something that I only learned when I tried to write down this Hamiltonian, but it's the relation between what the way a topologist speaks, which is in terms of equivalence classes, like isotopy classes, and the way sort of physics works, where you have to define things by conditions. So if you have, say you have a Hilbert space, and you have an equivalence relation, like x equals y, then
what are x and y?
Well, these are the axes. So, suppose I want to impose this equivalence relation. I can say x plus or x minus y equals 0. So I can say that the equivalence class of any point is the line through that point. Equivalence class of this point under this equivalence relation are all points made by adding an element on this line. So I could take the equivalence relations. I could apply the equivalence relation, take the quotient space where all these affine lines are crushed to points. And then the quotient is simply the perpendicular space to the relation. So, you know, that's all I'm doing, is I'm taking what from a topological point of view are relations, the relation of isotopy and the relation of removing a circle. And I'm looking at the relation space and the Hilbert space they define, and then projecting onto that, writing out Hamiltonian which projects onto that, and then the kernel of that projection is the perp to the relation. So a succinct way of saying this is the perp to a relation is a model for the quotient space. Right? If you have a subspace in a Hilbert space and you want to describe the quotient, that's the same as the perp. So, let me try to give some insight into the ground state of this Hamiltonian. So, as I said, it's explicitly engineered, so its ground state is a copy of the temporary Lieb algebra on a surface. And if it's a surface with some boundary conditions, then it's the temporary Lieb algebra with those boundary conditions. Now, loop gas was in the title, and I want to come to that now. If you take any vector in this ground state space, psi, and you observe it in the classical basis, this means that every vertex you just look to see is the spin up or down. So that means you're applying the operator sigma z. So the eigenvalue would be 1 if it's up and minus 1 if it's down. So if you observe in a classical basis, what you'll get is a probabilistic classical state. Okay, so it'll be some probability distribution over pictures of embedded curves on the surface. And it turns out that it's this multiplicativity, the fact that each circle counts for d, so two circles count for d squared, three circles d cubed, that translates into saying that it's a Gibbs state. That is, the probability of observing a component psi I is just the number, that number sign refers to the number of closed circles in the configuration. It's just the number of closed d, that real number raised to the number of closed circles, squared. And the squared comes in for the usual reason in quantum mechanics that the probability of observing something isn't proportional to the coefficient, but the square of the coefficient. So this means, since the probability has this exponential form, you can easily rewrite it as e to the minus some Hamiltonian. There, I just wrote, solved it for you. So it's some kind of Gibbs state, and that's the connection with classical loop gases. So, you know, in statistical mechanics, there's just a small grab bag of things they study. You know, these 6, 8, 24, 32 vertex models, the icing model, the Potts model, loop gases. I don't know, maybe one other, ice model. So there's a small list, and the Gibbs weight for a loop gas is always written this form. N comes from the ON models. The weight of a configuration is some number raised to the number of components. And actually, this is so-called self-dual case of a loop gas. The general Gibbs weight that you see on a loop gas has a length term. We have e to some constant times the length. But I explicitly, I'm glad not to have that length term there, because that would interfere with equivalence relation under isotropy. I want this democracy under isotropy. I don't want a loop weighted more or less because of it being longer or shorter. So I don't want to build any string tension into these loops, and it's not built in. So this model, this loop gas, is actually very close related to a familiar model, the Potts model, on n squared colors. And this, many of you know that in two dimensions in the Euclidean plane, 4 is the critical exponent for the Potts model, where its behavior goes from a second order to a first order phase transition. And the way the numerology works out is 4 for the Potts model becomes 2 for the loop gas model. That's where loop gases change their behavior, is at n equals 2. And that corresponds to d equals the square root of 2, which in my slide, that's responsible for the end of the stable region. Just to understand why something might go on as you change the base of the exponent, this Gibbs weight says that the Hamiltonian likes configurations with many loops. It likes to see a sea of foam, a lot of short loops. Gets more weight. But if you think of on a surface, you try to cover the surface with tiny loops, like each one hexagon size or something, you see that there aren't very many ways of covering the surface with those loops. So even though each of those has a lot of energy, negative energy, there's a minus in the Hamiltonian, even though each of those is to be favored, there's low entropy to those configurations. There aren't very many ways of drawing them. What has more entropy are the longer configurations, which can wiggle into many different positions. So just like in Brownian motion, you know, there's the weight associated to a path is larger if it's differentiable, but you still don't see differentiable paths because there are so few of them. It's a similar thing with these loop gases. The most weight is put on very short, tight configurations, so-called bubble phase, individually, but there may be very few of those that the actual mass of the measure may lie on longer wiggly loops with correlations. And when this happens, that's the critical regime. And whether this happens or not depends on the size of the base. If the base is a big number, then it favors many loops so strongly that you only see this small contracted bubble phase and things are stable. And if the base falls to 2 or lower, then you're in a critical regime where the typical loop actually has is polynomial size. So I want to conclude with just telling you what the evidence is sort of for thinking that stable phase might exist, at least mathematically. That is, why did I put that hypothetical diagram up showing that I expected perturbations of the Hamiltonian to lead to this system DEL? Well, the first bit of evidence is simply confidence from the quantum Hall systems. That is, we do know that topological phases can arise, can self-organize in nature. It wouldn't be unprecedented. Second major point is uniqueness, the fact that the algebraic fact that there's this one ideal of interest in the temporary Lie algebra. So I have to try to explain what does an ideal have anything to do with physics? Because an ideal is something in algebra, and what is physics? Well, an ideal an ideal is essentially a local condition. If you take a number and you multiply it by 7, that forces it into the ideal of integers divisible by 7 right away, and you don't have to look elsewhere. So the translation between algebra and physics should be that you should think of something being an ideal as something specified by local conditions. And once you absorb what that means in this context, it's a tautology to take the theorem and C-star algebras and translate it over here and say that modulo an ansatz, the perturbed ground state, would have to be a quotient algebra, and therefore this anionic system. So what is the ansatz? The ansatz is that when you study perturbation theory, you take the initial Hamiltonian and you try to understand how perturbation can act on its ground state space, and then the lowest the lowest order at which you see an effective action, the lowest eigenstate of that action, is taken to be as a model for the perturbed ground state. So the ansatz is simply to believe that the model for the perturbed ground state is picked out in a very sharp way. That is, that it's the joint null space of a family of local projectors. So this is simplifying assumption, but there are interesting examples in mathematical physics, which I list a couple of at the bottom, where one sees the ground state picked out in this way as the null space of some conditions. One comes from quantum Hall effect, where inside the Landau levels, the Laughlin states are found as the null space of joint angular momentum operators. And another is this dimer covering paper of Chase, and Kivelson, where you project away from certain top spin states in order to find the dimer covers on a lattice. So it's, whether this ansatz is applicable is debatable, but if one takes this ansatz as sort of the simplest model for a way a perturbation could act on the initial, on the unperturbed ground state, then the resulting quotient is unique. And the last point of evidence I think that's worth mentioning is an interesting thing having to do with the positivity of the Markov trace pairing. So in quantum computing, everyone is very central idea is this idea of a code space. And one way of expressing a code space that, for instance, it's in Gottesman's paper on survey and error correcting codes, is you have a vector psi that's in a code space, then if there's a linear space of errors for which this is a successful code, then it'll be the case that the scalar that's formed this way by applying an error to the vector will be a constant which depends on the error but independent of the code vector. Slightly more geometric way of expressing Gottesman's condition, which I like, is suppose you have a subspace of a tensor Hilbert space with this tensor structure, and you want to know, is this a code space with respect to a local family of errors? then this condition amounts to saying that if you include the code space, you act by an error, and then you orthogonally project back to the code space, that composition has to be scalar multiplication. So you can't affect an interesting transformation on the code space by the error space. You can't rotate it, for example. So there's this important notion of code space, and these topological things, by their very nature, are code spaces, these anionic systems, because they don't see what happens in a disk. So that's the sense in which they're immune to local error. And it's a formal consequence if you have a code space as the ground state space of a Hamiltonian, and if it was stable, if there's a spectral gap, it's a formal consequence that the structure induced from the ambient Hilbert space, restricting the inner product of the ambient Hilbert space, is the same as the Hermitian structure inherent on the code space from the Markov pairing. Those two cannot differ if there's a gap. This is some sort of adiabatic argument. And in particular, what comes from this immediately is that the Markov pairing has to be positive because the standard inner product is positive definite. So this is a non-trivial sort of consistency check that we see this positive inner product coming out in two ways. So in particular, it means that if we built the original Hamiltonian not with the golden ratio, for example, in the L equals 3 case, but if we build it with its Galois conjugate, we could define exactly the same algebraic structure and we could get a null space for the Hamiltonian, but it could never be stable because the Hermitian, because the inner product on the conjugate theory is not positive definite. So somehow the this particular family of theories, the ones with D, the 2 cosine pi over L plus 2, is being picked out for you in terms of the positivity of the induced form. So maybe I should stop there. Yeah.
Do you want your Hamiltonian to give energy cost proportional to for tiny loops proportional or old loops? Do you want to calculate loops or tiny loops?
Well, yeah, the interesting thing is in the presence of the first term, those two are equivalent. Because the first term was isotopy democracy, and a large loop can then be shrunk to a tiny loop. So the value of a large loop is the same as the value of a tiny loop. But that would do that only if it didn't collide with another domain wall?
Sure.
Well, that would be very interesting to discuss, yeah. Well, the
I'm saying, the thing I'm getting at is that I don't understand how your second Hamiltonian loops would be a local interaction.
No, no, it is. It is. No, no, no. I mean, that's a good question, but certainly it's local. I mean, can you see the board if I write here? So we have this Hilbert space spanned by the classical configurations. And this was my original H. This was just the the ambient Hilbert space, okay? And then there's a quotient map to what I was calling the temporary Lieb algebra. So this divides out by these relations, isotopy and something about the value of a circle. Okay. Well, yeah. Okay. I'll try to get to that. And now take any functional here. F, say, to C. Then what ground state, according to this Hamiltonian, is? So being in the ground state space is equivalent to being of the form summation, call this composition here G, G psi psi. Okay, so in other words, this is a precise expression for the statement that it contains two facts. One is that, it's a psi I there, is that if you have psi I and psi j, they're isotopic. So in particular, because they're isotopic, they go to the same thing in the temporary Lieb algebra. So the functional takes them to the same value, so they have the same coefficient. So that's the isotopic democracy. Also, if you have two states that differ by a circle, okay, they become the same thing in the temporary Lieb algebra, up to a scalar d. And then the coefficient will differ by that factor of D. Right.
Of states which are all reached by shifting the manual as well. So in particular, if I have one state with one gradient capacity, and another state which changes the control of the time, there's going to both be in that ground state with the flow. Now when I look at the second
term,
I don't see how
it's okay. So to have something to talk about, let's say we have these two configurations, and you see why they should be equally weighted. Okay, and that's a little bit indirect, because it might have taken 20 moves to get from here to here. But the point is that each move has to be equal weighted on both sides, right? So equal are finally equal, right? Okay, now let's consider this configuration and this configuration. We know that these configurations have to have equal weight, right? Again, it's maybe 50 moves between them, but each move is an equality, and composition of equality is equality. But we know that this configuration is equal to d times this configuration.
Okay. Well, what happens if d is not what you want it to? D is 1% off.
Well, so I think that certainly you can't. If this is like some adjustable parameter in the system, you're never going to get it to be the golden ratio. But I tried to present some evidence that these would be stable phases. I mean, it's a mixture of hope and evidence and so on. It's the usual, it's sort of what I think of as physics at its worst. but anyway, nevertheless, that's the status. So if you believe that it's reasonable that this is stable, then you shouldn't have to get exactly the golden number. If you get 1.6, you should still be in the basin of attraction of this phase. I mean, that's sort of, as I understand it, the meaning of a physical phase is that it tolerates some perturbation, right? That water is still roughly water, whether it's at 1 or 2 degrees centigrade, right?
I mean, this is basically related to Jim's previous question. I mean, the fact that heat is exactly what it's supposed to be means that you're going to count if you're going to smoke it and vice versa.
No. That's a different story. If d is a little bit off, for all values of here's the point. The specialness, it doesn't come in at this level of the temporary Lieb algebra. For every value of d, whether it's one of these special algebraic integers or not, there is this quotient, and this Hamiltonian, unperturbed, defines this quotient space as its ground state. The miracle occurs when D is one of these special numbers. There is a reduction of this algebra to a quotient algebra. Now, the process of reducing a degeneracy of a ground state is usually thought of as a linear process. You have, you know, some subspace, and you want to find a further subspace, which when you, you know, break a symmetry or something, the system collapses to. But what I'm saying here is that in addition to the linear structure, there's also a multiplicative structure which should be considered. And that's the composition in the temporary Lieb algebra. And that if you ask what reductions are compatible with the multiplicative as well as the obvious additive structure, then there will be no such reductions in the case that D isn't special. And if D is special, there'll be one such reduction. So in the case that there's one such reduction, it really jumps out at you. You know, it's like it's being called attention to. It's a wonderful candidate. You know, whether it's realized is another matter. So let me put that little phase diagram. Let's see. Here it is. So this I'm using a very standard ansatz in mathematical physics. So, whether there's a gap is some question about a quantum mechanical system, okay? But we can think for a moment just about the classical system, which is the made by observing the loops, okay? And what's known perhaps should be in quotes, but what's thoroughly believed in the statistical mechanics community is that as you cross this number, the square root of 2, the classical loop gas, which is the ground state, goes from being critical to being bubble phase. This means that if you're down here at 1.4 and you look at a typical loop, it'll be 1 over polynomial size of the field that you're looking in, and the field you're looking in will have full size loops going across it. And if you go to 1.8 and you look at a typical loop, it'll be just be a tiny bubble. Okay, so this is known to happen. Now, this the way this is spoken of in classical physics, statistical mechanics, is it's the difference between exponential and polynomial decay of spatial correlations, okay? When we're in the stable regime, the bubble phase, we have basically no correlations, exponential decay of correlations. We have quite strong correlations in this regime, polynomial decay. And now the ansatz is that spatial correlations are the same as imaginary time correlations. So if the spatial correlations are decaying exponentially fast, then the time correlations should, the imaginary time correlations should be decaying exponentially fast. And the only way that can happen is if there's a gap in the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. So that's sort of this is sort of a standard ansatz for looking at for trying to interpolate one's understanding from a classical system to a quantum mechanical one. Yes?
Can you explain in your interpretation what is the correspondence, for example, how you can explain such things like this anti-quantum bits?
The what?
Anti-quantum bits.
Anti-quantum bits? The classical quantum interpretation, yeah. So I have to admit, I've never heard the word anti-quantum, but in the general scheme of things, though this model has qubits as its foundation, we'd never try to calculate with a qubit. So I said, we put a spin a half particle in each vertex, so those are qubits. but we never tried to take two nearby vertices and do a controlled knot to them. We leave that alone. We regard this as kind of a very crude Hilbert space, and we're only going to try to make any kind of calculation in a very thin subspace, which are topological degrees of freedom in this space. And the kind of motivation for doing this is certain calculations, which Alexei Kataev was, I think, the first one to point out in this context, suggest that there's an exponential scaling to there's an advantage to be gained by separating these the excitations that you braid them around, which scales exponentially in the length scale. So one believes in the, you see, the reason really is that there's small tunneling effects, that if you think you've turned a particle around clockwise, there's some amplitude that actually you dragged it the wrong way, that both processes can happen, but because these particles have some width. But if there's a spectral gap and the particles, as expected, have these exponentially decaying tails, then one expects that this these errors decrease exponentially. So this is a this is kind of in favor of the anionic approach, that there's some parameter at your disposal which produces this very favorable scaling, encourages you not to try to compute with the local degrees of freedom at all. Yeah. Yeah, well, so this is, I've never done even the simplest calculation because it didn't interest me. But in order to do something like this, there's some braid which corresponds to Shor's algorithm applied to a given integer. And what braid it isn't, in my mind at this point, worth figuring out, because there's nothing canonical or beautiful about the answer. It's, you know, Shor's algorithm can be reduced to some sequence of Hadamards and controlled knots and whatever, and braids are dense in the rotation, you know, the unitary rotation, so they can be, their image is dense in the rotation, so you can approximate these Hadamard gates by certain braids. And what you know from the approximation theorems is that the error goes like, you need you get 1 over log epsilon, let's see what, log 1 over epsilon?
Log to the 5.
Log to the 5, 1 over epsilon. Well, it's actually log squared, probably, 1 over epsilon. Anyway, you get a very, you get from the point of view of the, you know, polynomial time notions of favorable scaling. You approximate fast enough that there's no theoretical problem there. Whether it's a practical problem, it doesn't look like much of a practical problem. So that's encompassed by this compiler that I mentioned at the beginning. The compiler has to figure out what the braid is, and then that has to be executed in the quantum device. And the details of the compiler would involve the Kataev algorithm. Yeah.
Why don't we continue the compiler?
Thank you.